This is Audible.
The Thrill of It. No Regrets. Written by Lauren Blakely. Narrated by Aaron Mallon at Brickshop Audio, Inc.
Prologue. 6 months ago, Harley. I'm a sex addict and a virgin. I know everything about sex, and I've never done it, though I came close last night. I know nothing about love. I know men. I can size up a guy in seconds. If he wants my sweet and innocent side, or my sophisticated persona, or if he just wants me to shut up and nod while he talks about his day, because some just want to talk. I know how he'll like it, how he'll want it, and I know by the end of the hour or two if he'll request me again. But those days are behind me. The past is the past. This is now. That's what I have to believe as I walk into a church in Chelsea off 9th Avenue to repent. It's a fading white church, rather plain-looking, unremarked by flying buttresses or soaring angels. The white brick is streaked with gray from soot and dirt, and New York itself breezing by over the years. There's a requisite steeple on top, unassuming, but still there, pointing to the sky, and a small plaque outside the doors that declares its non-denominationalness. Every flavor of fucked up is welcome. On Mondays, you can find the alcoholics. On Tuesdays, the former drug abusers. On Wednesdays, this place is home to those trying to kick the gambling habit. And tonight, I will spend the next hour with people like me, who are addicted to love and sex. Sex and love. Some to both, some to only one. I know both in ways I never wanted to, but in ways I still long for, too. That's the problem. I am 19 years old, and I have kissed 24 guys, which amounts to 4 guys per year since my first kiss at age 13. I kept a running list of their first names and how they rated. They were all ones or zeros. Those names on the list are all the reasons why I'm pushing open these wooden doors, the brown paint cracked and peeling. Fitting. I am cracked and brittle, too. Hardened by all the things I saw, and mostly all the things I heard over the years. I spot the first sign and I stop in my tracks. The blocky letters wallop me with the reality that I now belong to a club I never wanted to be in. On a sheet of white paper, the words SLAA College have been written in all caps with a big blue marker. How embarrassing. As if anyone can't figure out what the acronym means. But still, I follow the arrows on the sign pointing to the stairwell, then down the musty wooden steps that creak at every footfall as they announce my descent to the basement. More signs are plastered to the flimsy brown ply wall, more arrows directing me through the dark hallway, around the corner, then past another bend, deep into the bowels of the church. My insides are comprised of knots tightening in and wrenching around themselves, pinching all my internal organs. I wish that I weren't going here. But yet, I have to. I took the fall, and that brought me here. I run my fingers across the fabric of my red shirt that's touching my shoulder, tender today after my new tattoo, my reminder of who I was. But even so, the reminder on my skin is not enough to quell the nerves. They snake through me, setting up camp in every cell of my body as I enter a standard-issue Sunday school room with thinning brown industrial carpet. Earlier in the week, this room was probably crammed with cutesy blue wooden chairs adorned with drawn angels, clouds, and fluffy bunnies. Now, it's filled with cold, hard, folding metal chairs for addicts. The walls are bare, except for a few inspirational posters. Hang in there, with a kitten dangling from a branch. Perseverance, with a man climbing a snow-capped mountain. And patience, with a lone woman standing at the edge of a cold beach in the winter. I'm 5 minutes early, and there's one other person in the room. A thin woman with pink hair cut in a stick-straight bob rises and greets me. "Hi, I'm Joanne. Welcome to the slaw meeting," she says, pronouncing the name of the group like slaw. "Layla," I mumble, not sure how words are even coming out of my mouth as I give her a fake name. There is no way I'd use my real name here. Besides, Layla is the name that brought me here. Layla is my other name. Layla is the other me. I shake Joanne's hand. It feels smooth, and she smells like lavender. Maybe she just put on lotion. "Coffee?" She smiles brightly at me, as if coffee is the answer to every addict's deepest desires, because it's the only acceptable drug. I am a junkie. I take what I can get. I nod, barely able to speak. I sit in one of the chairs as Joanne pours coffee from a pot into a chipped ceramic mug with the slogan, "When in doubt, don't." Great. If only I'd had a collection of mugs emblazoned with "Keep it simple" and "Just for today," maybe I'd never have slid down that slippery slope into Layla. "I'm so glad you're here, Layla," Joanne says, flashing me another happy grin. "Do you knit?" Crap. Do I have to make small talk with her? She gestures to her canvas bag, spilling over with yarn, steely blue knitting needles, and what looks to be the start of a maroon scarf. "I'm not very crafty," I say, and leave it at that as she talks about the scarf she is working on and how she's going to pair it with a matching sweater. And I simply smile at her without showing any teeth. There, I'm keeping it simple. I'd rather go mute for this meeting because my mouth feels like cotton and my head is a pinball machine, and the last thing I want to do right now is talk about how my life has spun out of control. Except for last night. Because there is one guy who didn't make it on my list. One guy who never felt like a list. The guy from last night who inked my shoulder and kissed my body and who gave me something I've never felt before. Touch without agenda, a true and real want. He didn't want anything more from me than me. It was such a foreign feeling, but such a wondrous one. I'll never see him again. Soon, the room starts to fill, and I keep my head down, doing everything I can not to meet their eyes. I don't want to know what other addicts look like. I don't want to know if they look like me. I stare at my shoes, my Mary Janes, the black buckles shiny, because it's always shiny, because that's what made me top of the line. I was the whole package, the shoes, the plaid skirt, the white blouse, the beyond innocent look on my face. I hate that I miss that me. I miss her terribly. Even after last night and all that it could have become, all the ways it was different from the past, I still miss me when I was Layla. The circle of chairs has been filled in with guys and girls. I scan their faces, and all I see are their secrets. Then my blood goes both hot and cold when he walks in. The guy from last night with a scar across his right cheek. Trey.
This is the last place I want to be, even though it's the only place I should be, seeing as how I have a permanent reminder on my face of what happens when you go too far. I'd be able to handle this better if I could extradite the memory of last night from my stupid head, but I can't, because she staked a home in my skull, and the images aren't going away anytime soon. That girl who walked into No Regrets, the West Village tattoo shop where I work, was the hottest girl I'd ever seen, and so damn innocent looking. A combination that killed my self-resolve to start over. She had a sweet smile, a sexy t-shirt, and a skirt that left just enough to the imagination at first. She wasn't like the women I was used to. She was the total opposite. She wasn't like my regular customers at the shop either. She'd never been inked, and she didn't look like the type who'd want to mark up her body. She was the kind of girl who'd wear pearl earrings, blow dry her hair, and apply pink lip gloss. She was all Manhattan preppy, gorgeous blonde hair and brown eyes, and so not the type for a tat.
Can you do a red ribbon? The one I sent you when I made the appointment?
Yeah, I can do whatever you want. It's all ready for you, I said, then brought her back to my booth and showed her the transfer paper based on the ribbon design she'd sent me online. I figured it was a cause tattoo, like for all those charities that use red ribbons. Anything special about red ribbons?
They're special to me.
That was all she said on the subject, but we talked about everything else, music and school and what we wanted out of life, as she sat in the chair and pushed up her sleeve to her shoulder. It was a damn good thing I knew how to concentrate, because I could smell her. She had on some kind of wild cherry lotion, and the scent drove me wild, along with her hair, her eyes, her body. Which made zero fucking sense, since I've never been attracted to girls younger than me. Never, ever, ever. But maybe the scar I'd landed last month was all I needed to change my ways. When I was done with her tat, she said thanks, then turned on those hot little heels and started to walk out. That's all. Nothing more. But I wanted more. My shift was over, so I followed her to the door. Don't go, I said. I didn't have time to craft a line or feed her some bullshit, and trust me, I know how to feed lines. I know how to spin them on the spot. But I didn't want to lie anymore. We went out for coffee. We wandered around Manhattan, and we rode a midnight train where I first kissed her. There was this strange vibe in the air, like we were in Europe and had met on a backpacking trip and only had 24 hours to spend. So we spent them together. There was a ticking clock all night long. We went back to my apartment near school, and I hadn't had a thing to drink, but I felt buzzed and tipsy just being near her. We didn't go all the way, but she let me touch her. She wanted me to touch her. She told me she'd never let anyone touch her the way I did. Hell, if that wasn't a crazy turn on, I don't know what is. Nothing could even compare to it. So when I walk into my first meeting of Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous, I grab the doorway and hold on tight. This whole room is rocking like we're on a ship and hit choppy waters. I must be seeing things. There's no way she can be here. My heart trips over on itself, then it sputters out of control and collapses. Harley. She's the only girl I've ever been with who's not older than me. She's the only girl who didn't feel like a fix. And evidently, she's a lot like me. No wonder the clock was ticking last night. We both took one final hit before going on the wagon. I grab an empty chair and try not to think about her during the meeting, but it's impossible, because the night with her is the last I'll have like that for a long time. Even this Joanne lady running the show issues the reminder, some sort of rule we should follow, a guideline so we can stop being fucked up from sex.
And it's recommended that you abstain from sexual, romantic, or any type of love relationships in your first year of recovery,
Joanne says, while her knitting needles click faster and faster. But I've never been one to heed warnings. At the end of the meeting, I walk up to Harley, who calls herself Layla. What were the chances? She seems nervous, worried. She looks down, away, then at me and whispers,
"Everything I said last night was true."
My heart thumps faster. Good. I say, and wish her words didn't turn me on so much. I know I need to stay away from her, but I don't want to. I want something with her. We could be friends, maybe. She nods and smiles.
Yes, let's be friends.
At least it's something.
Chapter 1. 6 months later, Harley. I am more than halfway done. I tell myself that as I walk purposefully to St. Patrick's Cathedral, taking a deep, steadying breath. Trey is by my side. He holds my hand. He almost always holds my hand. Correction. He almost always holds my hand when we're far, far away from the rest of them.
It's what friends do,
he says. And I hope he says it to remind himself of our rules. Rules we have both followed to the painful white-knuckle letter. No touching, no kissing, no nothing more whatsoever. But this we allow. Only we never talk about why. We never discuss what happened the night before we met again. There is some unwritten rule that we are on the other side. But I won't truly be on the other side until I can slice off this albatross, this debt. I have been up late, up early, and up all around. I have been living and breathing and choking out the words this woman demands of me. All the tawdry tales, all the names, anonymously, from my list. She makes me dive into them, makes me share the story behind the kiss, the man, the where, the when, and most of all, the why. Make them titillating, but reviling, too, she says. Make sure you come across as someone who desperately needs redemption, absolution. Sometimes I wish I could punch a hole in the story of my life that I am forced to write for her. Memoirs of a teenage sex addict. Trey grips my hand tighter, looping his fingers through mine, and I shiver. I'm not cold. It's May, and it's warm, and any kind of contact from him sends me soaring. The more I know him, the more I want him, and the more I can't have him. We are in recovery, and he's told me many times he wants to make it through.
I don't need another one of these,
he'll say, then run his index finger absently across the scar on his right cheek. But I love his scar. I want to trace it and kiss it and touch it. Scars are sexy. They say you've lived and that you've survived. That's how I see him. But I don't want to be the one who knocks him off the wagon. So this friendship, this hand-holding, is all we allow. No fooling around. That's what we promised to do in Slaw. 1 year, alone. Without anything. Without kissing. Without dating. Without relationships. But abstinence, withdrawal, a break, whatever you call it, doesn't stop my worn-down, wasted heart from wanting this boy by my side to be more than my friend. I squeeze back, taking the slightest bit of contact with him. I've never held hands with anyone before. The men who ordered jailbait teenage call girls weren't the type who liked to hold hands. Shocking, right? Trey flashes me a grin.
You can do this, Harley. It'll be over soon.
I scoff. Not soon enough. When we're one block away from the church, I say goodbye. And this is where you must go, my sweet escort. He raises an eyebrow.
I should have been an escort.
You'd have been the best. Anyway, I don't want her to see you. She'll find some way to dig her claws into you. He looks over his shoulder as if he's checking out claw marks on his back.
Damn, I still have some other ones there. Scars everywhere.
I swat him. Fine. This is another allowed touch. I like your scars. Besides, I'm sure you had many marks on your back.
Covered in them. Everywhere.
His eyes light up. There's a part of him, too, that misses his past, longs for his drug. Get out of here, boy toy. This is how we operate. I know his past with women. He knows my past with men. And we can tease each other. No one else knows my past.
Call me later, though, okay? Let's hang out after I'm done with work.
Of course, I say, because we are addicted in a new way now, to contact with each other. We talk every day, text every day, see each other most days. He salutes me and walks off to catch a subway back to the East Village, where he'll spend the evening studying history for his final exams, in between making permanent marks on the skin of customers. I walk one more block, grit my teeth, narrow my eyes, and tell myself I am iron. I am steel. I am unflappable. I enter another church. I never thought I'd spend so much time in them for reasons other than worship. I grip my field hockey stick in one hand. I don't even play anymore. I simply like weapons, and I like flexing my fingers around it as I pass through the musty vestibule, ignore the holy water and the candles, and take my customary spot in the fifth pew from the back, laying the stick across my bare legs. I've been summoned by my dark overlord, and I can't say no. Such is the life of a former teenage call girl who's being blackmailed. It's a Tuesday afternoon, so there's no service now. I glance around at the other churchgoers. A few scattered faithful are here, or desperate, depending on how you slice it. As I scan their bent heads, I wonder if anyone hears their silent pleas. Maybe some are even asking for forgiveness for their sins, which is what I'd be doing if I were a religious girl. But I'm not. I hear the familiar sound of Miranda's heels clicking across the stone floor. 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2. When I reach one in my head, she's sliding into the pew, maintaining a 2-foot distance between us, as if getting closer to me would infect her. I kind of wish I had pink eye, could touch my eye, then zoom in on her with the pad of my index finger just to watch her pull away and freak out. But then she'd find some way for me to pay for that, too. She says nothing as she stares at the sweeping altar ahead of us. Her golden blonde hair is piled high on her head with a clip, her medium-length bangs swept over her ear. She looks amazing, especially in her sharp gray skirt that fits well and the pretty indigo blouse she wears. She's lost about 20 pounds in the last 6 months. I want to tell her it wasn't the 20 pounds that did it, but she'd never believe me. I'm dog poop on her shoe, a gnat buzzing by her ear, the smoke alarm that won't stop bleeping. I am nuisance made human with killer legs and face to boot. I am her worst nightmare. Or I was until she realized she could turn the tables on me. She bows her head, clasps her hands together, and steeples her long fingers, pale pink polished nails meeting at the points. I imagine what one would look like chipped. She'd shriek in displeasure, like a kettle on permanent boil. I stifle a smile. "You should pray, Harley Coleman," she says crisply. "It's not my thing." "It should be." "Thanks," I say, but don't give in to this request. To others, yes, but not this one. Rule number one when being blackmailed, maintain some lines. The more you bend, the more your extortionist tries to break you. She begins a low prayer, inaudible to anyone else, but crystal clear to me. It's the Catholic prayer of purity. "Jesus, lover of chastity, Mary, mother most pure, and Joseph, chaste guardian of the Virgin," she says, the icicles in her voice stabbing at the last word. I roll my eyes and bob my head as she continues on, substituting "begging you to plead with God for me" to "begging you to plead with God for Harley." She finishes with, "Have mercy on her." Though she doesn't mean a word of what she's saying, there is no mercy for me from her. Well, unless I told my mom everything, and telling her anything or everything is the one thing I will never do. Never, as in never, ever, ever. Rule number two, know your own lines. I'm stuck here, protecting my mother. I have to protect her. "Ah," she says with a hearty sigh and a hugely false smile. "I feel so much better, don't you? Cleaner, right? Like I just took a bath in holy water." She glares at me. "You jest in God's house?" I nod. "I do. I do jest in God's house. Frequently, in fact. I'll take the pages now." She holds out her long-fingered hand to me, her wedding band with its sapphire and diamonds reflecting across the stained glass windows. I dig into a side pocket in my purse and hand her a thumb drive. She takes it, looking at it with disdain. It's part of the routine. I give her a thumb drive every time, and every time she regards it like a diseased object. "You couldn't bother to print it out?" I don't have a printer.
She snorts, then slips it into her vast purple purse.
I want this book done soon. One more month at the most. You need to work on the next chapters and make them tawdry, make them sordid, make them as lurid as they can be.
I inhale sharply. This woman is sick.
Then give her the redemption she doesn't deserve, Miranda adds in her cool, calculating voice.
I stand up, eager to play even a lowly two of clubs in the form of leaving first.
I'm late for my British Lit class. You can expect a follow-up from me sometime this week.
Sometime? Like any time?
She shrugs smugly. Perhaps any day of the week.
Rule number 3, know when to bluff.
If you don't tell me the day, I'll tell my mom everything.
She may hold most of the cards, but the thing about blackmail is everyone has something to lose, including Miranda. I don't want my mom to know about the book she's forcing me to write anonymously, but she doesn't want my mom to know she's making me write it either. She purses her lips.
I'll email you.
I can't wait. As I scoot out of the pew, she grabs my wrist and her pink nails dig into my skin. I fantasize about brandishing my field hockey stick and whacking her upside the head. There'd be a brilliant gash across her forehead. Blood would ooze into her blue eyes and leave a sticky trail in her blonde hair.
Don't sass me,
she says in a low hiss, determined to have the last word. I yank my wrist from her, clamp my lips together, and let her have what she wants. My silence. I leave, but I don't go to British Lit because I don't have classes today. I have a dinner at my mom's house. It is date night with a new man, and so she needs me there. She always needs me, and I need her. Memoirs of a Teenage Sex Addict, page 3. It's been my mom and me as long as I can remember. I don't remember much about my dad, so this story won't be about him. All my memories are of my mom, starting with how unhappy she was after my dad walked out when I was 6. My mom was miserable for more than a year. She cried late at night, deep tears that could fill rivers and overrun their banks. She thought I was asleep, blissfully in dreamland and unaware of her pain, but I heard her phone calls with friends, her "what did I do wrong, please," and her desperate, endless self-doubt. She missed the bastard, against her better judgment. She tried to hold it together during the days, but I'd still find her crying in her cereal or wandering aimlessly around the apartment, sniffling and missing and hurting.
"Don't cry, Mom,"
I'd tell her, and she'd wrap me in a tight embrace.
"I won't, darling. I have you to make me happy."
After endless days and nights like that, she started to heal, to let go, and eventually the sob fests died down. Then she was ready to start over, to carve out her new happy. Dave was the first after my dad. I was in 3rd grade, and Dave spent many nights at our house. He had a son 1 year older than me. Sometimes when Dave visited in the evenings, my mom told us to play together. She and Dave wanted to chat and have some time alone.
"I'm happy again," she'd whisper to me before she closed the door to her room. "Isn't it great to see me happy?"
"Yes, Mom."
"You'll play with Dave's son. That would make me so happy right now."
His son was 9. I was 8. We played Monopoly. Technically, I count Dave's son as the first time my mom set me up with someone. Not that anything happened with him, but that's how it all started. And this is the story of how I became a high-priced virgin call girl by the time I was a senior in high school. Kick back, grab a glass of wine, and prepare for the sordid, salacious tale of how I became Layla. Names have been changed to protect the innocent.
Innocent?
Ha, as if anyone is.
Chapter 2. Trey.
Elevators were my downfall, but I can handle them better now. The doors open with a soft metallic moan, and I step inside the mirrored elevator in the Lexington Avenue office building. The lift shoots me up 6 floors to my shrink's office. Dr. Michelle Milo. I head into the lobby. It's empty, and that's good because I'd rather not see who else is fucked in the head or the heart. I walk to her office and tap on the door.
Good afternoon, Trey,
she says in the calm voice I'm used to. I'm pretty sure shrinks don't have any other voices. It must be part of shrink training, how to speak in a serenely modulated tone all the time. Never waver, never vary. I wonder if shrinks are all peaceful and even on the inside, too. Unflappable, never bothered by the shit life serves up. I can't even imagine what that would be like. Like living inside a Valium, maybe. Hey. I flop down on her couch. She's been my shrink for 6 months. And granted, she's totally my type. Maybe a little young, since I think she's in her late 20s. But I've never had a single dirty thought about her. Not one. Maybe that means I'm getting better. Maybe I'm not so hooked on older women. Maybe I'm breaking my addiction.
So, she begins, clasping her hands together. How is everything going for you this week?
I shrug. It's fine. The school year is almost over.
And your plans for the summer? No regrets full time?
I nod.
How are your parents about that?
I roll my eyes. My parents. My perfectly plastic, perfectly put together, perfectly empty parents. They wish I were going to school to be a doctor. Yeah, like that'll ever happen. Guess how they are with that, I say sarcastically. Can we talk about something else?
Whatever you want to talk about, Trey. This is your time.
I look away, at the plants on her windowsill, at the books on her shelves. Books with names like Real Choices, It's Not Love, It's Addiction, Healthier Lives, all the shit I need to be. I stare at her walls and the framed abstract art. Red squares, yellow brushstrokes, blue lines all mixed together. I'm glad she doesn't have those stupid inspirational pictures. I'm tired of seeing it slaw. She waits for me to speak. Harley, I say in a low voice. I always want to talk about her.
You want to talk about Harley?
It's not a question. It's a statement. Sure. I offer in the most casual offhand way I can muster.
Harley, the girl you spent one night with and have now become best friends through a love and sex addict support group.
She states, but there's no judgment in her voice. I cross my arms. You think it's dangerous that I'm friends with her? Michelle shakes her head.
No, I think it's worth exploring how and why you're actively focused on recovering from your addictive behavior, and you spend most of your time with someone who also has that goal in mind. And yet, she also happens to be a young woman with whom you've been intimate.
You think we can't be friends because we almost slept together? She shakes her head.
No, I think you can be friends. I also think the situation is complicated and unusual, Trey. Because you've gone from feeling as if your life was spiraling out of control and deciding to go to slaw, to meeting Harley, to becoming close friends, and sharing both the details of your past and your recovery with her. Is that a correct assessment of the last 6 months?
Yeah, I say tentatively, and I have the feeling of being subtly cross-examined, even though I know that's not Michelle's style.
And yet, you and your parents don't talk about what brought you to slaw. You don't share it with friends. You don't share it anywhere but here and with Harley.
My jaw tightens and my shoulders tense. I feel like you're calling me out on something.
I'm not, but I want you to think about why you're able to be this way with her, why you go all over the city with her, and she meets you after work, and you hang out in between classes, and you know all about these memoirs she's being forced to write, and you, by your own admission, are not a terribly open person. So why her?
I picture Harley, her blonde hair, her brown eyes, her banging body. But then I shift away from the physical, and I flash onto all the other parts. And honestly, it comes down to pretty much one thing. I can talk to her about just about everything, I say.
You can.
Michelle nods.
Except one thing. The why behind all of this.
I run my palm over the tattoo on my shoulder, underneath my shirt. The why of all of this.
Harley. As soon as I open the door, the familiar greeting pours forth. You look so pretty, my mom says in this incredibly reflective air, as if this is the first time ever in my whole life I've looked so pretty. I'm wearing a short skirt, a t-shirt, and my Mary Janes. I look like I do every day. Still, no matter what, without fail, you can set your ever-loving clock to it. You look so pretty is always the first thing my mom says to me. I wish I hated it. I wish I didn't need to hear it. But I ache without it. It's become as necessary as air and sun. It's my confirmation that all is right in the world. She raised me to be pretty. She trained me to be pretty. She is pretty too. The difference is she never used her pretty to win things in life. She earned all her accolades, all her praise, all her awards. She doesn't even hang them on the walls or frame them. She's so humble, brushing them off as if they're nothing when people praise her. But they're not nothing. She's won national awards from every journalistic association in the world, it seems. She's earned the most prestigious prizes in her field, since she's a top-notch investigative reporter on Here and Now, the venerated show that has exposed government secrets about the wars. Not to mention high-profile politician shenanigans. My mom uncovered the sexting senator, the congressman who hired young male escorts to give him blowjobs on Uncle Sam's dollar, and a child prostitution ring run by an ex-New York City mayor, Barbara Coleman. Her name even sounds like a kick-ass reporter who takes no prisoners. She is the most feared whistleblower in America, and her two nonfiction books have topped the bestseller lists. She's been called the cleaner, and I'm told that politicians shudder and quake in their boots when she starts investigating them. She's been relentless in her pursuit ever since my father took off when I was in first grade. She kicked him out after several affairs. Then, with the help of her editor, who plucked her from the assignment desk, mentored her, and fed her reporting opportunities, she refashioned herself into some sort of avenging angel, a righteous doer of good, exposing all the evils behind closed doors. She is one of the most admired women in America, and she has a slut for a daughter. She stands tall and regal at the stove, stirring a pot with a long wooden spoon. She wears a flowy magenta blouse, the color so blazingly rich she looks like royalty. She's paired her top with trim black slacks and suede pumps, and her raven-colored hair is pulled back in a comb. She's beautiful, and she is ready for a new man. Hi, Barb. I leave my purse by the door as I head into the kitchen. I'm making Moroccan stew tonight, in honor of you being nearly done with your second year of college, she says coyly. I'm not sure why she says it coyly, but perhaps she's flirting with the stew. But, of course, British lit originated in Morocco, I say, since English is my major. I love to write, but not the kind of writing she does, and not the kind of writing Miranda makes me do. I like to make up fantastical tales of talking animals, magical doorways, portals to other worlds. Only, I don't really have the time to do that kind of writing anymore. I used to have notebooks and journals full of tales, until Miranda subverted my love of words with her twisted debt. But I don't like thinking about Miranda when I'm here. My mom winks at me, loving our sisterly banter and jokes. That's what we are, sisters. Who's coming over tonight? She screws up her forehead. Maybe she can't remember. Or maybe... No, not this, not now. Her eyes go glassy and her lower lip quivers. Not Phil, she chokes out, dropping the spoon and covering her eyes. I pull her to me, wrap an arm around her. It's okay, I reassure, even though I wish she'd never met Phil, her last boyfriend. Tears leak onto my shirt as she heaves out several thick sobs. "I miss him," she moans. "I don't know why he left."
I do. I know why he left. I won't tell her, though.
"Because he's a jerk, and you deserve better, Barb,"
I say, because she doesn't like me to call her mom.
She nods against my chest and sucks in her breath.
There, she's pulling herself together. One hug from me, one firm but loving reminder, and that's the magic formula to make Barb Coleman happy again.
"Forget about Phil, okay? Get that dick out of your head and your heart for once and for all. Now, tell me about this new guy."
She pulls back, exhales, brushes a hand across her cheek to wipe away the streaks of her sadness.
"His name is Neil, and he has a son who's just as good-looking," she says, and winks at me knowingly.
She picks up her dropped spoon and resumes stirring.
"I want you to meet him. I think he might be perfect for you."
I cringe inside, and a new knot of nerves takes hold. I hate being set up, but I don't know how to tell her this. Not when she's given me everything. Not when she's the only one who's been here for me since my dad is quite simply gone. Off in Europe with his new bride, or so I hear. I don't talk to him, and he doesn't talk to me. I haven't seen his parents, either, my grandparents, since they split, and we used to visit them often. Some days, when I'm feeling hollow and empty, I miss those visits even more. They don't even write or call, not even on my birthday, and they promised they would. They promised they'd tell me stories of the times I spent with them. But when my parents split, I was excised from everyone. All I have is Barb.
"It would make me happy. You know I love playing matchmaker," she adds.
That's what I want. The desire to take away her sadness fuels me every day.
"What's his son's name?"
"Connor. Lovely name, don't you think?" "No, it's just a name. It's neither here nor there. It tells me nothing about him."
"Yes, great name."
I press my fingernails into my palm so I can feel the flesh starting to pierce. The prospect of one of her setups makes me desperately want to return to Cam, the man who made me Layla, the man I miss. I dig harder. I need the visceral reminder to stay strong, to keep on course. I will not bend. I will not break. I will not go back to the way I was. Layla is gone. Layla has been put out to pasture, and I am my mother's daughter. Good, honest, righteous. I picture my red ribbon tattoo, my reminder of how much I love my mom, of all the good times we had, our mother-daughter bonds, all the tests she helped me study for, all the times she took my temperature when I was sick, all the nights she tucked me into bed, the only parent there for me, every single night. How I will do anything for her, including protect her from the truth about me and my call girl days with Cam. I try to practice all the mantras Slaw has taught me. This too shall pass. The 3-second rule. Let the past be the past. There. Better. I won't think of Cam and his baby blues, his sandpaper stubble, his faith in Layla to reel them in. We were partners in crime, partners in secrets, partners in power. I miss my partner terribly. My mom stirs her concoction.
One of my sources sent me this recipe. She knows I love to cook. It calls for peanuts and carrots and sausages. Gotta love a sausage fest, I say with a smile.
Harley. She pretends to shoot me a chiding look, but she loves that I'm one of her girlfriends.
Want me to set the table?
That would be divine. And don't forget wine glasses, she says, then wags a finger at me. But none for you.
Of course not, Barb. I'm underage. I don't drink.
She gives me a soft peck on the forehead.
You are such a good girl.
I flash her the smile she loves. I am her good daughter. I am her prize pet. I make her happy. I reach into the cabinets for the yellow plates. They are her middle-of-the-road place settings. If she can't quite remember the guy's name, he hasn't earned the fine china yet.
I lay them neatly on the table, then align the silverware and cloth white napkins. Wine glasses are next. Red or white? She purses her lips and considers. Stu calls for red, don't you think? I nod, as if I'm a wine connoisseur. Absolutely. Merlot? You always know the perfect pairing. Yep. Soon, the doorbell rings, and Neil arrives with his son Connor, one of the very many men my mom has set me up with throughout my life. Connor is a decent-looking guy, and he's studying finance in college, and he likes the Yankees. And I put on my best pretty pony show, laughing and flirting and bantering with the best of them. And I know that Connor is falling hard for me, because it's so easy to reel them in. She trained me. She taught me. She made me who I am. Then Cam made me better. Cam made me the best. When dinner ends, my phone rings and it's Trey, reminding me he's closing up in 30 minutes. I have to go. Forgot about my study group, I say, and excuse myself as soon as dinner is over. But Harley, my mom calls out, truly saddened by my departure. We're having such a nice time. I know, but I have a calc test and I need to go. I'm lying, because I don't have any more tests, and after another show, I need to be with the one person who requires no lies. Wait! She scurries from the table, pops into the kitchen, and returns with a Tupperware container of blonde brownies. My favorite. For you. I made them earlier. I take the brownies. Thanks, Mom. I say, slipping in a mom, even though I know she'd rather be Barb. Memoirs of a Teenage Sex Addict, page 12. When I was in grade school, my mom hosted elaborate parties every month. She was celebrating her liberation, she claimed, from a marriage in chains. A marriage to someone who didn't want her, didn't love her, who loved other women far too much, who cheated and strayed like he was earning points in a video game. Before the very first party, more than a year after my parents split, she brushed my blonde hair till it shined and tied a red ribbon in it. She dressed me in a red dress with spaghetti straps and a sparkly bodice. When I watched her do her makeup, I asked if I could wear some. Of course, she said. And thus began my first lesson in how to apply makeup properly. She let me wear blush and eyeshadow, even demonstrating ever so carefully in the mirror how to use a shadow brush. Then she paraded me around, introducing me to everyone the same way. This is my daughter. Isn't she pretty? I smiled my prettiest smile, sometimes even gave a curtsy. After the fourth or fifth party, I was a show horse, a little pony, a figurine she'd acquired from Tiffany's. By then, we did our makeup together before a fete. I'd bring my little wooden stool into her bathroom and stand on that as we peered in the mirror and put on our faces. It was our ritual, our bond, the way we became sisters rather than mother and daughter. Then it was party time. The ratio of men to women always tipped in favor of the Y chromosomes. It wasn't a party unless the pickings were plentiful. She'd bring me round and introduce me. Here, honey, I have someone I want you to meet, she'd say, and I'd flash my best smile as she continued. Isn't she pretty? Isn't she pretty? Isn't she pretty? I was good at writing, too. Still am. I eat stories for breakfast. I read them. I write them. I plot them. I breathe them. But somehow, I never got the, this is my daughter, she's good at writing, introduction. I was pretty. That was my purpose. Is it any surprise I became what I am? I was programmed for this. Chapter 3. Harley. I thumb through Trey's drawings in a portfolio at No Regrets, stopping at an image of wings. Feathery, pillowy wings that could whisk you away to a better world. I flash back to the time he created this tattoo image, late one night at his apartment. He drew in his sketchbook, and I huddled in the corner of his futon, laptop on my knees, pounding out every word Miranda wanted me to write, chronicling my lurid stories of the 24 men who were my downfall. He stopped sketching, sat next to me, and swiped the tear from my cheek that I barely even realized was there. I don't think I was even aware of how those tales Miranda demanded would be an excavation and unearth not only memories of all those men, my mom's and mine, but the way I felt. I'd never shed those tears when I was younger, never when any of it was happening. Only when I revisited them, all with my gut twisting, my heart splintering, Trey by my side. He knows everything about me. He's the only person I've ever let in. He learned my wishes and hopes the night I met him, and he learned I had secrets the day I ran into him at Slaw. So really, I am an open book to him, and he to me. Add that to all the reasons we can't ever be, because no one wants to be with someone they truly know. I glance up from the portfolio and watch him. He looks so sexy in his well-worn jeans, a t-shirt that shows off his strong arms, those tattoos snaking down his carved muscles, black ink, tribal patterns, lines and shapes skating over his skin, everything in threes. His shoulder is marked with three suns, his chest with a trio of silhouetted birds, symbols of the people he never knew, he's told me. That's all he says about them. He won't tell me more. He locks the drawers where he keeps his equipment, straightens up the portfolios that grace the wooden tables in the entryway, and then closes up. I hand him a brownie, and he takes a bite.
It makes me crazy that your mom is such an awesome baker, he says.
I know. You wish she were all bad.
Sometimes,
he says, and I tuck the Tupperware container back in my purse as he finishes the brownie. What did you ink tonight? I ask as we leave the shop, and my ears are assaulted with the screeches of cabs and cars, my nostrils with a blast of exhaust from a nearby bus turning onto Christopher Street.
Some dude came in wanting 2 arrows on his bicep.
Did it mean something? Trey nods.
He's in recovery. He used to drink himself stupid. Said it means it's the pain of the arrow coming out, not the arrow going in.
I haven't heard that one. Must not be a regular Joanne mantra.
Yeah, me neither. But do you think it's true?
I shrug as we pass a sleek bar called the Pink Zebra. It's a magnet for cougars. My chest seizes up, and I silently hope that a whole pack of them won't spill out as we walk by. Trey's temptation. Sexy 30-something women. But I have no such luck. The door opens, and two gorgeous skinny women emerge. One is wearing Jimmy Choo's, the other Louboutins, both decked out in painted-on jeans and slinky tops. I want to cover his eyes so he can't see them, but I'm too late. He's drawn to them, moth to the flame. But they turn the other way, and we keep walking. I ignore the look of hunger I saw in his beautiful green eyes as he shakes his head, as if he can shake them off.
I guess,
he says in a low voice, then trails off. Maybe his mind is wandering back to the women, or maybe that's all there is to say because we both know what's unsaid. Some days, the arrow coming out hurts like hell. Some days, you miss your drug like you can't even believe. Don't let anyone tell you otherwise. Withdrawal is a bitch on wheels. It feels like someone is ripping your fingernails out with pliers.
How was dinner tonight? Did your mom try to set you up?
It was the usual, the way it always is.
Did it make you miss Cam?
We stop at the light on 7th Avenue, waiting to cross. Cam. Trey's question pierces me, because no one would ever ask it. No one else could. I can't seem to tell my mom the truth, or my roommate Kristen, or even Joanne at Slaw. But Trey, the only guy who's ever made me feel any sort of reckless abandon, any sort of true desire, apparently I can open up to him about taking money for not quite sex. Do I miss Cam? I muse out loud, as if I'm turning over the words, considering them from every angle. With a vengeance, with the blaze of 1,000 suns, with every piece of twisted DNA in my body. Cam is the arrow. I miss being his, being in control, being powerful. I want the arrow back in. Being Cam's was the only thing that ever made me feel like my life wasn't orchestrated by a master puppeteer. Maybe a little, I admit.
Did you call him?
I shake my head. Not calling Cam is a daily battle, but it's one that makes me hate myself. Because how can I want to hold hands with Trey and yet still miss Cam like a phantom limb? I am gross. I am disgusting. Miranda is right. I don't deserve redemption.
Have you ever gone skydiving?
I stop and stare at Trey's non sequitur as an ambulance zooms down the street, its horn blaring. What kind of segue is that?
I don't know. Maybe we just need a thrill in our lives. Don't you miss the high?
Every day, I admit as we cross the street. Miranda forced me to go to Slaw, but I knew I belonged there because I was drugged on love, on almost sex, on power. Knowing didn't stop me from wanting my drug, though. I am dependent. I still am. Trey stops at the subway entrance.
Maybe we just need to find the daring in the everyday,
he says, then perches on the railing that leads down into the subway station. He's seated on the edge, holding on with his hands. He leans so far that his back is nearly parallel to the sidewalk. Trey! He lets himself fall further, so his head is upside down. It's New York, so most people ignore him, but a few of them on the steps below point as they keep clicking down the stairs. Trey hooks his feet around the bottom of the railing and then lets go with his hands. His head, arms, and chest drop down. Rationally, logically, I know he's not going to fall, but all I can picture is his gorgeous face smashed to bits on the concrete far below.
If you're worried, just grab me,
he says, as if he doesn't have a care in the world. I reach for his brown leather belt and jerk it hard, yanking him upright. His face is red and near to mine, and the air is crackling like an electrical storm. My heart is racing and my adrenaline is surging, and I'm no longer thinking about Cam. I'm thinking about this guy, so close to me. His mischievous grin, his sparkling eyes, how they know me, see through me. How I let him in that first night and we talked about everything. Music, happiness, the future, even my grandparents who I never see and who I miss terribly some days. I'm remembering, too, the way I felt when he first kissed me, then touched me, then his mouth on my body all over me, soft and slow and caressing, like something I wanted. Fuck, I can't go there. I haven't let myself think about our one night in ages.
You know I won't fall.
I shake my head. You know that scares me, I say. I don't let go of his belt. He places a hand on my hand, skin on skin, his flesh on mine. I try not to shiver, but it's useless. I do anyway, as my stomach executes a huge somersault.
I'm like a bad horror film director. I can't resist scaring you because you're so damn cute when you get scared.
He jumps down off the railing and engulfs me in a hug, wrapping his strong arms around me, pulling my face to his neck. God, he smells good. All sweat and work and some woodsy scent that's just so him.
Sorry about Miranda and your mom and all those stupid guys,
he says softly in my ear, just for me, just to me.
I don't want you to be with any of them. I don't want you with anyone.
I dig my fingernails into my palms to stop from pressing my body into him, from whispering kisses across his neck. Because this Trey, this soft, sweet, caring Trey, is the only guy I ever let touch me without agenda. The only man I wanted to kiss. The only man who's ever made me come. I never faked it with him. I never knew not faking it could feel so good. That giving in, letting go could be scary and intoxicating all on its own. Now, with him so close, arms looped around me, his smell in my nose, his strong body pinned against mine, I don't know anymore what happened to withdrawal, because nothing feels painful right now. I only feel potential, possibility, the slim hope of starting over, like a stone skipping across the water, whisking up a few drops. Maybe this is the new high. He skims one hand once across my back, so lightly it could be a friendly touch. But even through my flimsy shirt, my insides flutter like hummingbirds, and my mind is back to our night. His hands on my naked skin. The unfamiliar ache in my body that craved more of his touch, of the way he seemed to memorize me with his palms and his fingertips, as if he needed to trace every inch to imprint the feel of me, the outline of my body in his memory. Then his lips everywhere, traversing my arms, neck, breasts, belly, legs, ankles, and back up to calves and knees and thighs, then in between. His lips and his tongue made me want to die and live and soar. I'd never let go like that, never moved like I did with him, with abandon, with desire, with the sharp, sweet rush of wanting someone to touch me for the first time. I let go with him. I gave my body to him, in a way so many of them would have paid top dollar for. But I didn't ever want anyone to see me like that. To watch me, feel me, hear me come. Maybe he's the arrow. Maybe he's the thing I'm not withdrawing from. The one person who knows all my stories, the one person I've become best friends with in recovery, is the only one who knows exactly how I feel, what I think, what I want, what I hate, what I need, who I am. I don't know how to be known like this. In this naked kind of way, like I've taken everything off and I'm waiting for judgment or touch. Maybe they're one and the same. I sigh once, then manage to pull away from his grasp and look at him, giving him a quick nod. Thank you, I whisper. He tilts his head to the side, his hair falling past his ear. His hair is light brown with hints of copper. It's thick and full, and he could be a shampoo model, only he doesn't have that overly coiffed, perfectly combed look. His hair is deliberately undone, purposefully tousled, and all I want is to run my fingers through it and cling to it and never let go. Hold his cheeks in my palms and kiss deeply and without regret. Hear him groan, let him do the same to me. Look in his eyes, see myself reflected back, because his eyes, like the rest of him, are beautiful. They're the color of a forest, of a green beer bottle, of lush grass after it rains. They are the reflection of every girl and woman falling in love with him, because they all do. Then there's his face, strong cheekbones, the stubbled jawline, and his scar that tells me he's like me. He went too far. He hurt others. He was hurt. But that hurt is part of the connective tissue of our strange friendship that blurs all sorts of lines, that spills over into the feeling of more, even if we don't truly venture there. Sometimes he looks at me like he wants to go there again, and he can probably tell, too, that I still want him that way. It's so hard not to rake my eyes over him. He's tall and sculpted, and I bet if you turned off all the lights and it was pitch black and there was a sea of shirtless 21-year-old guys, I could find him by touch. No one has ever felt like him. But if I acted again on these desires, then he'd be 25. And if he's 25, then I'm just the same. And I have to be different. So only when I stop wanting him, stop feeling for him, stop thinking about him, can I have him? But even then, he'd never have me, so it's a moot point. Besides, what do I know about feelings? Nothing. They make zero sense to me. I don't know if they ever will. Trey.
Her hands on my belt drive me crazy, but I won't be the one to break her. She is trying so hard to be good. She is so fucked by Miranda and by her mom, and I hate all they do to her. I can't be the one to lead her down this path, even though I think of her all the time, and the memory of our night has fed my imagination countless times. The trouble is, I know she's dying to see Cam again. And I know I'm fighting all these stupid chains that my past keeps clamping on me. The other day, I stopped by my parents' building to have dinner with them, and it was like walking into the lion's den. Everything about that place reeked of my past, of all the afternoons I'd spent in those corner penthouses with those women, those pent-up, ravenous women whose husbands never gave it to them enough, or whose husbands had grown tires around their midsections and bald patches in their hair. Like Ms. Roshman in 10E. I nearly ran into her in the lobby the other day, and seeing her brought back the memories of how needy and hungry she was. She used to run her fingers through my hair and hum happily, like she was blissed out beyond any and all recognition. I was 18 then, and she loved to be on top. Her fake breasts barely moving as she rode me, her wine-red nails raking through my hair.
God, Trey, I love your hair. You have so much of it, she said.
Didn't take a genius to figure out Mr. Roshman was on the thinning side upstairs. Her husband, a corporate litigator, never found out. He still travels all the time, defends companies from lawsuits, and ignores his hot wife. She still wants me to not ignore her. She crooked her finger to call me over when she spotted me in the lobby a few days ago. I pretended I didn't see her. I faked her out with the earbuds I had in, screaming trees blasting in my head. I wear them every time I go to my parents, so I have an excuse to ignore them all. I try desperately to avoid all the beautiful women who live there. I can't not go. My parents pay for college. They want to know how I'm doing. They want to know what I'm learning. They want to know if I'll switch majors and study medicine like they did and become a plastic surgeon. That ship has sailed, Dad, I said the other day. Still, they try. They'd rather I change my mind, stay in school for many more years, turn pre-med, become a respected doctor in the family, not a guy who studies art and history and works part-time at a tattoo shop. I'm their only hope, after all. There's no one else. When I make my weekly visits to their building, my parents and I serve up uncomfortable small talk. We dart around all the things and people we're not allowed to bring up, like they never even existed. They taught me how to ignore the obvious. But I can't ignore Harley. She's not like them. She's not like anyone I've ever known. It's almost enough to make me tell her why my family doesn't talk, why we are so closed off. Messed up and perfectly plastic on the outside. But I've told no one except my shrink. Harley tells me everything, and I can't manage to give her the simplest truth. I never learned how. Maybe that's why we can never be together. That, and the rules, and the group, and the fact that I'd never know what to do with a girl like her. She's a girl. And I only know women. And I only know sex. I don't know what to do with someone who's not a game. A conquest, a way to numb the pain. With her, I'd have to be myself, be honest and truthful and let her all the way in. Besides, Harley's a former call girl, so really, the fact that I want to inhale her all night, to run my tongue from her delicious earlobe, down her neck and between her perfect breasts that are real, that are so fucking real and soft and full and demand to be kissed every time I see her, is irrelevant. She would never want me the same way. That one night was a last hurrah, a final goodbye to the past. She could have anyone, but she hardly seems to want anyone, except Cam. And the thought of that makes my skin crawl. I don't even know the guy. She told me she was never involved with him, but he was her fucking pimp. He whored her out, and that makes me hate him. That makes me want to do to his face what the husband of the lady in the penthouse apartment did to mine when he caught me with his wife. I should go, I mutter.
Me too,
she says. Are you going back to your mom's tonight? She shakes her head.
Back home. I'm sure Kristen misses me,
she jokes. Kristen and Harley have a run-down railroad apartment not far from here that's rent-controlled and has been for 100 years, or so it seems. Cool. I'm going to meet Jordan for a beer, I say, referring to my buddy who works at the coffee shop next to No Regrets. He hates coffee, can't stand the smell of it or taste of it from working with it all night long. He needs beer more than ever to get the scent of caffeine off of him, he likes to say.
Have fun. Tell him I say hi,
she says, and gives a playful wave, as if I'd pass that on to my friend. We should set him up with Kristen someday.
Yeah, they might like each other.
She starts to leave, but I reach for her arm. Damn, her skin is so soft. I could layer kisses on her arms and be satisfied. Actually, that's not true. Any kiss would make me want more. I'll walk you home.
You don't have to.
I want to. I take her hand, and the feel of her is the thing I want most and dread most in the world. But I can't stop holding her hand, even though I'd never know what to do with her for real. When we reach her building, she turns to me.
Did we even have plans tonight?
I shake my head. I just like seeing you. Maybe I've said too much. Maybe I haven't said enough.
I like seeing you too.
Better me than Cam, I say. Then want to kick myself for admitting that, for saying those stupid words. But I don't stop. Don't call him, please. I sound like an idiot, begging her. She stands on her tiptoes and brushes a soft, sweet, dizzying kiss on my cheek, on my scar, whispering,
I won't.
I want to believe her.
Chapter 4. Harley.
Were you at your writing workshop with the hottie tattoo guy tonight?
Kristen lowers her red cat's eye glasses and stares at me over the pages of a script. Kristen is a film major, and she always has her nose in a story. She's scrunched up on the couch in our apartment, studying a marked-up screenplay. Yeah, I say, the lie rolling seamlessly off my tongue.
Are you guys hooking up?
I scoff. No, it's only class. If only she knew.
Can I have him then?
She waggles her eyebrows. She's met Troy. She knows he's unbelievably beautiful. She has no clue how I met him, though. Sure, I say, as if the thought doesn't make my insides turn. I don't want anyone to have Trey, but I can't tell Kristen about the meetings we go to, the real way I know him. I try to throw her off the scent. Or his friend Jordan. He's cute too, don't you think? She nods knowingly.
Honestly, either of them would be fine. Why don't you just make that happen, Harley?
I'll text Trey that we should all get together and go see a band or something, I say, and then fire off a quick message. Kristen and I have been friends since the start of high school, but she doesn't even know the half of it, or the half of me. If anyone were to know about the slaw meetings, about my past, about my men, it'd be Kristen. She is my closest girlfriend, but that word, close, it's also relative. Close means you share clothes, dreams, secrets, maybe even the darkest of secrets. But that's how it's supposed to be. And sure, I know things about her because we've been friends since we played field hockey together at our high school. She was a beast on the field. She took no prisoners and was known far and wide for hitting below the knees. I asked her once why she had so much aggression, and she said she took out her frustration over her parents' crappy relationship when she was playing. They were divorcing when we were in high school. Here's the thing. She's open. She's let me in on her secrets. She struggled with bulimia when she was in high school, and she was in therapy our senior year to help her have, as she likes to say, a better relationship with food. I know her insecurities, too. Sometimes she's abrasive or too in your face, and it's all part of her tough gal persona. But underneath, she wants what most people want, happiness. I know her hopes, too. After college, she plans to jet west to California and become a screenwriter, chase the Hollywood dream. But I barely tell her anything. Maybe because she's so together, because she's battled her demons and won. Or maybe just because I'm no good at telling the truth. She knows I like music and doing makeup, how I take my lattes, that I like to invent stories about animals and magic, that someday I want to live on the beach and soak up the sun and sleep to the sound of ocean waves lapping the shore. She knows that my dad ditched us long ago to move to Europe and that I'm close with my mom. But more than that, I wouldn't even know where to start. I'm like that person who scatters clues across several states, making it tough for the cops to gather enough info or enough witnesses to assemble the whole sordid story. No one except Trey. It's weird that one person can know your before and your wish for after. And that's not Kristen. Because I haven't told her a thing about my mom's habits. And honestly, there is nothing I want to say. My mom is my mom. She needs me. I need her. She took me to every doctor's appointment, tended to every scraped knee, and read to me every night before bed. So what if she had men over all the time? She wasn't cheating on anyone. She was the one left. She was the person abandoned, and she finally found a way to be happy again. It doesn't matter that I knew all her boyfriends, that I heard her late-night moans and groans, that I know what it sounds like when my own mother has an orgasm, that I'm too familiar with the things she says when she's getting turned on. No one, no one, no one in the whole wide world can be privy to the fact that my mother, who has done more good for society than most people, has another side, the side that turned her daughter into a prostitute. Those secrets are lodged so far and so deep inside me, I don't even know how I'd get the words out. I'd need more than a shovel to dredge them up. I'd need a bulldozer to exhume them. And even if somehow, some way the words could tunnel out of me, I know they'd spill out my mouth all disfigured and unrecognizable, a foreign tongue no one could understand. Sometimes when I say the words silently, in my head, at a whisper, I can still feel a fierce red blush covering my cheeks. I was a call girl. But yet the real reason I don't tell her is this. Because I loved it. I loved the crazy burn, the rush, the thrill of the power. Because I needed it. I wanted it. I craved it. I still do. I'm not cured. Slaw hasn't fixed me. If Kristen knew where I really go when I say I'm at the writing workshop, she might not want to be friends with me. She wouldn't want to have lattes with me or share an apartment with me. I'd be the slut, the sex addict, the whore that everyone would think I am, that Miranda thinks I am, that all those stories, true fucking stories, that Miranda makes me write prove I am. No wonder Trey wouldn't touch me again. No wonder he keeps me at a distance. He's getting healthy. He's healing. He's moving on from his past, and he can see me for what I am. Dirty. Slutty. Whore. Soon he'll walk away, too. That's why I don't tell Kristen about Layla. She'd walk straight the other way. This is what people do. They leave when you get too close. Are you hungry? Nah, I ate at my mom's. I say, damn, I wanted to split a pizza. I'll eat a slice if it'll make you happy. I offer. I can do that. Kristen doesn't like to eat by herself. Says it reminds her of the times when she scarfed on food alone. She claps once and smiles widely. See, this is so simple. I made her happy by saying I'd have a slice. She dials her favorite pizza delivery place and orders a cheese pie. I wish I could do the same. Have a healthy relationship with love. I wish love were like pizza. She kicks her feet up on the coffee table. We should have a girls' night on Friday.
Let's go somewhere, meet some guys. There's no one at this college I like. I want a man, not some stupid frat boy.
No, you don't, I say. You don't want a man.
I've had men. Most of them are awful. Memoirs of a Teenage Sex Addict, page 107. I didn't sleep with any of them. I could lie and tell all sorts of sordid stories about being 17 and fucking 42-year-old men, but I won't, because I didn't do that. My pimp loved me. He took care of me. He would never have sent me on jobs like that. Sometimes I played the escort role to the buttoned-up guys who wanted the sexy young girlfriend at a fancy dinner function, or the suit who had a hankering for a schoolgirl on his arm at a bar. But I was also assigned the middle-aged men with weird fetishes, like one of my regulars. His name was Gerald, and he was a banker. We met every Friday at 4:15 when the markets closed. He wanted me to wear my green plaid skirt, starched white blouse, and my good old faithful Mary Janes. A regular meeting spot was a hotel in Midtown because no one knew him in Midtown. He liked to hear about my day at school, the things I learned in class, but he especially longed for my stories of what my friends and I talked about in the locker room. I made it all up. I told him we discussed lingerie and what kind of lacy underwear we preferred to wear when we masturbated. I wore a black bustier when I fingered myself last night, I told him. My friend Holly gets herself off wearing her red silk teddy. He'd start breathing hard, then ask for more. I served it all up for him. Tales of trigonometry and English literature, chiffon and lace, fingers and spread legs. Then he'd ask me to kiss him once, spank him 10 times, and tell him to sit in the corner. That was all he wanted, stories and spanking. I can only imagine what sort of fucked up shit he was dealing with to want that every Friday afternoon. Then I would find my pimp and tell him everything. He'd grin, pat my shoulder, and we'd toast, like we'd conquered the fucking world. Chapter 5. Harley. A needle clicks. Joanne is cradling her latest creation, an earthy-looking brown and yellow mass of yarn that appears to be transforming into a sweater. She knits at meetings because it became her hobby in recovery. I suspect she transferred addictions, sex to knitting, but I'm pretty sure knitting is healthier. She begins the meeting with an affirmation. I despise affirmations, so I look down and fidget instead as the others join in. It's Chloe, Ainsley, and me. Only the girls today. The guys are in a guys-only meeting a few doors down. I release the fear of rejection, the fear of pain, and all the past beliefs that have led me astray. I am comfortable with who I am. I think before acting. I seek honesty, truth, and trust in all my relationships. I feel all squishy inside as I mumble a word or two with the others. Sometimes it's too much therapy, too much insight, too much introspection here. Sometimes I want to rage against the calm, healthy, boundaried, love is not a battlefield, it's a quilt attitude. Why can't love be a battlefield? Life is a fucking battlefield. Who said love was supposed to be any different? Maybe there's no truth or honesty in love. There doesn't seem to be much in life. Not what I've seen. Not from Miranda. Not from Phil. Not from the assholes my mom busts with her investigative pieces. Maybe everyone, everywhere, is an addict of some kind. At least some of us admit it. Chloe says all the words, loud and proud, not missing a single syllable. Chloe is one of those super involved people, sharing every detail of her recovery, from having slept with 22 guys by the time she was the same age. Sometimes I think about all the stuff I know about Chloe from these meetings, but how we've never once hung out. And frankly, I don't think either one of us has the desire to. We just don't have that much in common, to be honest. She admitted a few weeks ago that she's had 3 STDs and 1 pregnancy scare. Yuck.
I didn't sleep with any of my clients. I drew lines, a lot of lines, and I didn't cross them. Before Trey, I never came close to going all the way. I never even almost did it. I stuck to north of the border, to places I could control. Mouths, tongues, lips, words, names. When I was with a man, I was in control, complete and total control, because I didn't let go. I didn't want someone's hands going there, drifting down, traveling to places on my body where I might start making sounds too. Nobody has ever heard me for real. Nobody but Trey. I don't hang with Ainsley much either, but she's new and started a few weeks ago. Teachers are her vice. She lost her virginity to her high school music teacher, then proceeded to work her way through the rest of the arts departments before she started college. I don't say much to them at the meetings. They're doing better than me. They're further along. I'm too ashamed to tell them I miss the man who sold me. I'm dying for a boy in the group next door, and my own mother wants to set me up on dates. But I don't have to talk today since we have a guest speaker. Joanne puts her knitting down and introduces a woman named Danielle, keeping it first names only, as always. She's 25. She's a total rock star because she's been on the wagon for... Joanne turns to Danielle as the two women sit down. How long?
4 years,
Danielle says. She's thin, with pointy elbows and sharp cheekbones. I wonder if she has an eating disorder, if she's anorexic and just channeled one addiction into another. Maybe Danielle will tell a tale that will remind me of me, that will help me move on, that will let me heal. But I don't even know what I'm healing from, except myself, my own bad choices, my own horrid decisions that brought me here. But yet, how can they be so awful if I miss them? If I desperately long for those moments? When I walked into a job, I savored the power, the control, the dominance. When my heels clicked and my hair swished and my lips shone, I thrilled to be in charge. As Danielle talks, my mind starts to drift, to return to that heady rush of a call from Cam, a booking from Cam, reporting back to Cam. The money was irrelevant. It was never about the money. It was about the way all my senses tripped into supersonic speed when his name appeared on my phone, when he delivered the details, the things to say, do, and not say or do. Wear the red satin dress from Bloomingdale's when you have dinner at Le Cirque with David. Ask him about business, and be fascinated with everything he tells you about computer chips. Handcuff Saul and run your hands down his back. Scold Carter sharply when you catch him masturbating in the hotel bathroom. Walk up to Robert and ask him to dance with you when Prince starts playing at the nightclub in Soho. John wants you to bathe him in a bubble bath. Quietly, say nothing. Everything was clear. Everything was decided in advance. I flash back to the jobs, hearing bits and pieces of Danielle's requisite story, how she desperately wanted men to think her pretty. She was told she was never attractive as a child because she was fat. Good thing you have brains, girl, her mom told her. That snaps me out of my daydreaming. My jaw tightens because who would say that? My mom would never do that. My mom would never tell me I was ugly. She would never put me down in that way. But I was a smarty pants, and I figured out pretty quickly that I could be skinny if I threw up, Danielle says. Yep, she's a cross addict, went from food to men. And it became a game to me in a way. It was all about control. And then I thought, maybe there are other things I can control too. You all know where this is going, of course, but I'll tell you anyway. I thought I could control men and sex. Getting the boys to notice me, the fat girl who was now skinny, became my new project. And if a boy didn't notice me, I'd amp it up, wear shorter skirts, tighter shirts, flirt more. And boys became like the ideal weight on the scale. This thing I wanted and had to have. I didn't sleep with any of them. I was a virgin when I graduated from high school. I look away, feeling a strange twisting in my belly. I don't want to hear her story anymore.
And I justified my behavior, because I didn't do much with any of these guys. Made out, kissed, a little more, but by the time I was graduating, I'd made out with a couple dozen guys in my school alone, even though I never did more than kiss.
Never did more than kiss. Those words echo, then circle me, threaten to ensnare me. I push my chair back and mutter, "Excuse me." I leave the room and walk down the hall to the bathroom, clutching my stomach on the way. I feel like I'm going to throw up. My stomach churns and twists. I push open the door to the church bathroom and it's freezing in here. It's May, so how can it be so cold? But it's like they're pumping ice into this bathroom. I jam my hand against the door of a stall, pushing so hard the metal smacks the inside wall. I shut the door and kneel down on the floor, pulling my hair back into a makeshift ponytail to protect it. But nothing happens. Nothing ever happens. I never barf. I never retch. I don't even dry heave. I just feel sick to my stomach. So I come here, and I kneel, and I wait as my gut tightens, like two hands are grabbing my insides, gripping them. I stay like this for a few minutes. Then I flush, flushing nothing. I stand up, leave the stall, go to the sink, and wash my hands. It's quiet in here. So quiet. No one is talking. No one is telling stories. And I find the silence a relief. I think of Cam, of how being his made me forget the noise that had surrounded me. With every gig, I was erasing all those sounds I grew up overhearing. Erasing the part I played at all those dinner parties. All those dates she set me up on. So, one note to Cam won't hurt. It won't set me back. I take out my phone and send off a note to Cam before I can even think about what I'm doing, before I can even contemplate. Hi, missing. I stop typing the message. What am I missing? Him? I return to the keys. I know what I'm missing. I know what I want. I want Trey. Badly. But I can't have him. Last night, when he wrapped his arms around me by the subway entrance, when I ran my nose along his neck and inhaled him, when his hand brushed my back and I sighed like I wanted him again, that only reminds me now of how vulnerable I felt the one time with him so many months ago. We're not together, and we can't be. So how can I live with being vulnerable, with wanting, with feeling? I don't know how. I don't have a clue. Love isn't a quilt. Love isn't patient. Love isn't kind. Love is a game, a chase, a thrill. Love is wild and warlike, and every man and woman must fight for themselves. I can play the game. I can control love. I need to feel in control. I need to hold the world in the palm of my hands, my world, my life, and be the one who sets it in motion. The only one. I'm not controlled. I control. I finish the message to Cam. Hi. Missing things. I hit send and return to the room. Joanne gives me a faint, sympathetic smile. I don't look at Danielle the rest of the meeting. I spend the time contemplating my fingernails and considering how to finish the next chapter for Miranda. When the meeting ends, Joanne asks me to hang for a minute. I pour a cup of coffee from the coffee pot on the table as I wait. It tastes bitter and sludgy, but I drink it quickly while Joanne makes small talk with Danielle and Ainsley. Then they're gone, and she turns to me. Hey, Layla. Everything okay? I nod several times. Just peachy. Just peachy? Who says that? What is wrong with me? But I have to act like I mean it, like I'm peppy and healthy. Otherwise, she'll know what I was up to. Sneaking off, texting my drug. She raises her eyebrow, noticing my weird word choice. Danielle really bugged you, huh? No, not at all.
Not one bit.
I say, if I lied to mother, to my flesh and blood, to the woman who raised me, I can lie to this lady.
Layla, I just want to make sure you're okay.
I want you to get the help you need.
She says gently,
can you rub out Miranda then? That's what I really need.
I am okay. I'm here anytime you need me,
she says softly, sweetly, kindly.
If you don't want to talk in front of the group, you can talk to me. I want you to know that.
No one has ever offered to help me before. Talk to me. I don't know what to say.
I have to go,
I say. Then I take off. Before I reach the top of the steps, I feel a buzzing in my back pocket. The possibility that it could be from Cam winds me up like I'm a slot machine and someone is about to hit the jackpot and all my bells and buzzers are whirring. I grab my phone and my fingers feel slippery as I unlock the screen.
Please, let it be from him. Please, please, please give me my fix.
It's not Cam, though. It's Trey, the other guy I want, the guy I can't have.
I'm at the coffee shop around the corner. Guy's meeting ended early. Come find me.
Part of me doesn't want to go. Another part knows I'll do what he asked. Come find him. Because at least someone replied. At least someone wants me.
Cam. Trey. Trey. Cam.
I feel like I'm seesawing back and forth, being pushed in one direction, then pulled in another by unseen hands. When I reach the shop, I spot Trey through the window. He gives me a curt wave, a guy wave, but his eyes light up. I push on the door and quickly join him at the wooden counter.
How was the girls-only meeting? Tell me all the tawdry tales,
he says with narrowed eyes.
Huh, it sucked. How's that?
He nods several times.
Know what you mean.
He gestures to his friend Jordan behind the counter.
Can we get this woman a triple espresso? 10-4, man,
Jordan says, and he turns the handle on the espresso machine. It hisses and whirs.
How'd you know I'd want an espresso instead of a latte?
Because when you get stressed, you need more caffeine,
Trey says, as if the answer was obvious. But it melts me, the tiniest bit, that he remembers these details, that he keys in on my stress without worrying or making it seem like a big deal. He just knows. He knows me. He's the only person I've let know me. I wonder if we'd have become friends if we met under other circumstances. If we met first in group therapy, would I have pushed him away? Or did meeting him at his shop, having him ink my shoulder, and then kissing and making out all night long. Is that why I kept no secrets from him?
That's cute, I say softly, that you remember that about me.
He raises an eyebrow, tilts his head.
Did you think I turned stupid in the last hour? We're friends, right? I should know these things.
Okay, so that's all. He remembers because we're friends, not because we might be more. I heave a sigh. I'm so out of sorts right now, from Danielle's story ripping up my heart, feeling all too familiar and all too foreign at once. I want to punch her mom, and I want to run away from Danielle at the same time. I want to spill all my guts and secrets and lies to Joanne now that she's invited me to lay them at her feet. I want to word vomit everything I've kept inside me. Every story I'm being forced to dig up for Miranda's twisted mindfuckery. But I want to shove all my secrets down and never let them out again, too. On top of that, I'm amped up from my own wait for Cam to reply. Maybe I don't want him to reply anymore. Maybe I do. Maybe I don't have a clue. Maybe I am still so fucked up. Maybe if Trey was more than a friend, I could get a grip. It's as if there's something ticking inside me, harder, faster, and it hurts more. A sharp metal object in my chest, struggling to break free. Jordan finishes the espresso and places it in front of me.
For the lady,
he says with a sweet smile. Jordan is adorable. He has dark blonde hair and blue eyes,
And the four of us, Trey, Kristen, Jordan, and I, are making plans to see the band Over the Edge on its tour after that text I sent Trey the other night. Jordan and Kristen would make a cute couple. Healthy. Normal. Not 6 degrees of fucked up. I reach into my purse for money when Trey gently brushes my hand away.
I got it,
he says in a low voice and gives Jordan the money.
Thanks,
Jordan says, and tends to another customer. You didn't have to, I say as I take a drink of espresso.
Hey.
What?
What's with you?
What do you mean?
You don't seem like yourself.
He lays his hand on mine, and like that, the tension inside of me starts to dissolve. His hand is safe and warm. When he touches me, I feel like I belong to something true. I take a breath, meet his eyes, and do the thing I didn't do in the meeting. Share. I don't know. It was just a weird meeting. This gal talked, and she said all this shit about how her mom wasn't nice to her, and it bugged me. Trey furrows his eyebrows at me, but says nothing. What? I ask pointedly.
Did it bug you because your mom wasn't always nice to you?
I tense up again. Why do you have to say that?
Because it's the truth,
he says, not backing down. She was nice to me, I mutter.
Harley,
he says, and the tone in his voice is both caring but also correcting, as if he knows I've made an error.
She wasn't. She made everything she did seem okay.
He tucks a strand of hair behind my ear, and I want to shrug him off, swat him away for saying crap about my mom. But I don't want to lose his touch right now.